I believe that when we take naps and we see each other and we laugh and we have them big belly laughs and we talk to each other and we, what you doing? Like that type of stuff, right? Like, mm-hmm. That cadence, yep. That soft cadence. Mm-hmm. That part, I believe our ancestors, they can let their shoulders drop a little bit and their face can soften and their sense of being has more space. And I also believe that it also allows for the children that are to come through with a sense of space that they didn't have, that they wouldn't have had if we hadn't have done this type of work.
Oh my goodness. Hello, beautiful soul. Welcome to Break the Cycle with Dr. Marielle, a podcast where I invite in some of my favorite healers from across the world to talk about how we shift from intergenerational trauma to intergenerational abundance. I'm your host, trauma-responsive holistic psychologist, Dr. Marielle Bouquet. Join me and my fellow healers as we break the cycle. I'm so deeply honored to have this guest in the podcast today, and I'm so excited for all of you to be able to share in his wisdom and in the potency of his words. Rezma Menakem is a healer, the New York Times bestselling author of My Grandmother's Hands, one of my all-time favorite books, which I have read 4 times, and his newly released book that you absolutely need in your bookshelf, The Quaking of America. And apart from being an established author, Rezma is also a teacher of embodied anti-racism. I also see him as a revolutionary and a community member that I'm deeply grateful to share Earth with because he is a visionary of our current times. And he understands the ways in which we play a part in our continuation of intergenerational trauma. And that the discontinuation of said trauma is largely situated in how we confront the racial turmoil of our present and of our past. Collective trauma hurts us deeply, and he's offering tools on how to take actionable steps against racial trauma while also staying present and safe in our bodies. So without further ado, here's Rezma. I want to thank you for being in conversation with me. I know you're going to shake this conversation up. I'm ready. I hope people are holding their hearts because we all need to be ready for the wisdom that you're going to impart upon us. So hit me with it. Offline, we were just talking about your book, The Quaking of America. Talk to me.
Yeah. You know, My Grandmother's Hands was my way. There was a number of reasons why I wrote My Grandmother's Hands. And one of them was that it helped me process some of my own trauma after Afghanistan. And it helped me, one of the things that it did, because Afghanistan was such a kind of pressure-filled situation that it forced me up against places that I never would have got up against some of the things that I got up against. But it also forced me up against some things that I had kind of left alone with regard to my grandmother. And, you know, just pieces of her that, you know, she's grandma, so you just keep moving. Mm-hmm. But there were some pieces in terms of her hands and stuff like that, that Afghanistan, because it was so much volume and charge and pressure, it forced me up against what she was contending with as a Black woman who started sharecropping when she was 4 years old with her father. Walking up and down rows and having the thorns rip her hands up. And so my grandmother's hands were, it was really my personal kind of foray into trying to work with both my trauma, my people's trauma, the trauma and the brutality of both enslavement, mm-hmm. Jim Crow, mm-hmm. and then what I call Neo-Crow, which I believe we're living in today. Mm-hmm. And so it was just a move towards working through that charge and getting to a place to where I could be open enough to receive her now. And so it was a very personal book, for at least from my personal space. This one, is personal in a different way. The Quaking of America.
Well, you know what? It literally cut off just as you said the title of the book.
Yeah. Here we go.
I'm like, oh, now you know they're listening to something like that. Like, we're going to cut this off. It's the agenda.
All day long. All day long.
Yeah.
You know, I got into it with this one dude who wanted me to do some work for him, and my team protects me a lot. And so they're, and the reason why they protect me is because talking about this subject coming from a Black body is different than a white person talking about this subject. And so my team was protecting me primarily because I get a lot of death threats. I'm constantly getting people talking crazy.
Right.
And so the way that my team works with me and the way that I protect them is, look, when stuff like that comes through, you don't have to pay attention to it, just delete it or whatever. But I think since like the late 80s, people have been watching me. That's just kind of my, that's just kind of the thing I think about.
Wow. What a layer to add to your experience, you know, in a Black body to have these vigilantes, if you may, in the mix.
The uptick of it happened after the Tucker Carlson mentioned my name on a thing, but Tucker Carlson and then Ben Shapiro, they mentioned my name, you know, when the whole CRT thing popped up. You know, it is what it is. I mean, if they want to get down, we get down. I mean, I'm not helpless, you know. So.
And you got a whole community with you. So, I mean, you know.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah. But that also is a testament to the power of the work that you're doing.
Thank you, sis.
It really is. And I mean that wholeheartedly. It's revolutionary. In my humble opinion, I believe it's the work globally that you're doing is some of the most revolutionary work that we have and will experience in our generation. And it may just be for generations to come. So I just want to take a moment to just appreciate you.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I appreciate you.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I was saying, you know what? Let me take a little pause. You know, my override game is so strong sometimes that even when people are trying to hold me, I just override and keep going. So I'm trying to learn how to not do that. So.
Yes. This is such good work that you're doing for yourself and for community right now. So I will be in this space with you. Take your time.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
So, you know, publishers, one of the things that they want to do is that they want to have, you know, when you got a hit, right? Just like if you was a musician, right? You get a hit, they want you to, let's do another hit.
Right, right.
And so one of the things that happened is that I actually started writing the book called Our Grandchildren's Souls. And it was basically a book on legacy. And how do you take a living embodied anti-racist idea or a somatic abolitionist idea? And then how do you create legacy around it so it transfers and transmitted and gets transmuted over time as opposed to just in the 30 years that you're working with it, right? And so I started writing that book and, you know, my agent negotiated it and they were like, yes, absolutely, let's do it, you know, let's do it. And your work is so important, where's mine? Da, 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 you know how they do.
Mm-hmm.
and then we're writing it and I'm about quarter, halfway through the book and January 6th happened. And I'm sitting there and my wife is upstairs and I hear her go, Resma! I was like, what? She goes, you got to watch this. So I run up the steps and I'm standing in front of the TV. She's standing in front of the TV and we're looking at the TV and we're seeing these fools starting to show up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I go and do some other things, come back up. She's still sitting there watching it. And now it's about 2,000 people. I'm like, okay, right? And now we're starting to see the nooses starting to show up, the symbol of the noose, right? And what I try and talk about also in Quaking is that the noose is not just a way to extinguish life, right? Mm-hmm. It is right. also a symbol that, at least for the Black body in particular, it is a symbol that that goes across time, right? It has a weight to it, right? And even if you've never seen a noose before, there's something about it to the Black body that quakes when we see it, right? Mm-hmm. And then I started seeing the Auschwitz sign. And then I start all of these symbols that are about feralness and brutality, right? Mm-hmm. Then these fools start kicking out the windows. And me and my wife is watching. And then my wife says it before I do. She goes, if that had been us, the first time one of our feet went through the window, our heads would have been blown off. And when she said that, I just sat there and I was watching, and then I said, and then she said, and then we watched them go inside and beat police officers, right? And here's the thing. These are the police, Blue Lives Matter, or, you know, these are those people, right? And this is why I say that white bodies get shocked by things like this. But there is no cultural container by which that shock gets turned into action. So what happens is, as it relates, there is none.
I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready. Wow.
Sis, white bodies have no racial acuity or agility collectively. None. Mm-hmm. Because they haven't had to. They haven't had to understand the vibe of race. Or when one meaning shifts from another meaning, or when urges show up, or when sensation shows up and you don't quite know what it is, but something says pay attention to it, right? Or some type of emotion shows up and then the charge shows. They haven't had to do that. They haven't had to do that. So when white bodies get shocked to me after 400 and 500 years of enslavement and brutality and genocide, that does not mean, and this is where Black bodies and Indigenous bodies and Asian bodies get it messed up. We think that white people shock means that white people gonna change. It don't mean that. That's the patterning.
Right.
They get you. Mm-hmm. Like what I told my wife is white people will see that and go back into their trauma response. And white people's trauma response when they watch other white people do carnal stuff, their trauma response is to go to silence.
Mm-hmm. Withdrawal.
Withdrawal. Oh. Right? Mm-hmm. Right? So mm-hmm. they go, oh! Mm. Oh.
So on the money. So on point.
Yeah.
It Absolutely. Does.
And we go, I better go take a psychological first aid class. I better go learn how to use one of these weapons. I better take a self-defense course. I better talk to my daughters and my sons and everybody about what's happening. I better, at least when I go into the barbershop, I better say, I better, right? That's what we do. We start thinking, they're serious. That's not what happens in white bodies. White bodies believe that whiteness will protect them when the glass breaking starts happening in their neighborhoods. White bodies believe that when these people with AR-15s who only believe in authoritarianism and strong man and only the strong shall survive, right? That's their ethos, right? When you don't align with that ethos, they're putting a bullet through your head too. White people don't get that. They don't see that those pieces, when you're watching somebody, 6,000 people storm the Capitol and crap inside of the halls and pee on the flag and beat Black Lives Matter, they don't believe or beat police officers. The reason why they beat the police officers is because they don't see the police officers in alignment with their philosophy. Mm-hmm. White folks have no collective understanding or agility to be able to navigate that. White bodies don't, because they haven't had to. And so the quaking came out of, I'm sitting there after that day, I'm shook. I'm like, I don't believe white folks. I believe some of us in Black bodies don't understand what that's a seminal moment.
Yeah.
Right?
It sends a message. Absolutely.
All the way through.
Absolutely.
All the way through. And if you see that message and that doesn't spur you to take that seriously, when this stuff jumps off, it's going to jump off and you're going to be wholly unprepared. And so the quaking was to get you prepared for if it happens, both in terms of embodiment, right? And if it doesn't happen, get you prepared to be able to sense into what things are showing up in terms of when it might happen in the future, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because it's going to happen, yeah. right? And I've had people say to me things like, you're an alarmist. You, like, you know, what you're talking about is you're an alarmist. And I said, no, I'm not an alarmist. You're just an idiot. That's not the same thing. It's not the same thing.
You better tell it. I mean, but, you know, but that's protective, right? If anybody who is able to utilize lack of knowledge as a way to not have to see reality, not to have to face reality, and then not have to actually put in place actionable steps to change the reality that is, you know, working to their benefit, then of course it's going to have a protective function. So of course they're going to, you know, anyone would choose to be an idiot rather than to take action,
exactly right.
which is,
exactly right.
right, which is, yeah, it's hard and necessary, right? And I know you try to protect, you try to prepare us for that in My Grandmother's Hands,
right? I did,
right?
I did.
You try to say, hey, can y'all, you know, get into your bodies?
That's it.
Because we got work to do.
We got work to do. And we need you to do this work. But what we ain't going to do, this is one of the pieces I talk about at the beginning of quaking, is that I said, it is no longer Black, Brown, Indigenous, and Asian bodies' job to cajole y'all to do something. If you're going to create culture, a living, embodied, anti-racist culture, it ain't going to be because the Black guru shows up and gives you the answers. You know what I mean?
You're hilarious.
Sis, they love having some exotic Black Panther show up, right? And give them the answers to this stuff, right? They hate being in the room with each other talking about race specifically. They can't stand it. They start ripping mm-hmm. each other apart. That's why they look for a Black guru, right? Or Asian guru. You know what I mean? That's why they look for that shit, is because what it takes to actually develop culture is not guruship. It's committing to another white body and saying, we're not passing the feralness of the white body supremacy down to the next generation, and we're going to start here.
Hello. Tell it, Rasma. And that you know, those difficult conversations that are also embodied conversations, because I know you're always talking about somatics, and especially cultural somatics, and the ways in which we carry generational pain that is racialized because we are not disrupting, right? And if they're not willing to create a disruptive space amongst themselves, none of this work is going to get done.
That's exactly right. There is no way for me to educate white folks into this. If education means only cognition. If what you did for me earlier at the beginning of this, when you just told me, let's just pause on that piece, right? That doesn't exist in the white community around race. What you just did as another Black body saying, bro, let's just, right? Because when you pause somebody, you have to deal with both the possibility of resource and the possibility of peril at the same time. And when it comes to race, the white bodies collectively are unwilling to do that work, to develop discernment over time with each other around race specifically. So here's the okey-doke. The other thing that white folks like to do is that they try and act like DEI is anti-racist work.
I can't help but to laugh. It's just so true that it's like comical.
Yeah.
It's like layers of truth. It's just wild. And I hear you 100%. But it's just not enough.
It is whole. Listen, I tell white folks all the time, I say, look, I want you to be nice to me. I want you to be kind to me. I don't want you to spit in my food, okay? But your niceness and your kindness is wholly inadequate to deal with the feralness that your ancestors created on this earth. It is inadequate, right? And if that's all you got is your kindness and your niceness, it doesn't work. You being nice, your individual niceness, your church bazaars, you're sending money to poor African children, your niceness, okay. But that is wholly inadequate to deal with the feralness and the brutality of white body supremacy. And so these pieces, white bodies, let me give you an example. So when I try and explain this to white bodies, some of them will take just offense. Like, why are you lumping all white people together? And why are you doing this? And why are you doing that? And I said, well, let me give you an example. Let me just. So there was once a black man who decided that he was going to quietly protest police brutality by kneeling on a football field. Quietly. What a lot of people don't know is that for a long time, he just did it and didn't say anything. And when he did that, what was the collective reaction from most white bodies? Right now, that man can't do what he loves because of most white bodies outside of the arena would lose their mind if he showed up to a football field and played for their local team.
And literally, quite literally lose their mind.
Yeah.
Like they could not contain the emotion that would produce and lose their mind.
Lose it. Because why? Because they have no collective container by which to hold the charge of race. So the black body is where white America and where America has always done its dirt. So the conversation that me and you are having right now, it is relatively new, sis, that the conversation that our two black bodies, and I'm not talking about ethnicity, people get ethnicity and body and pigmentation and pigmentocracy confused with each other. I'm not talking about nationality. I'm not talking about ethnicity, right? That when they came to get us, they didn't say, well, do you speak Spanish or do you speak French? They didn't. Do you speak Swahili? They didn't. They saw your black body and that black body was tied to their ethos around that the black body is deviant, the furthest deviance that you can get from humanness. The closest you can get to humanness is the white body. That ain't something our people created. And then they put that all. So the Spanish did that. The Spanish, what I call the Spain, remember there's the five superpowers, Spain, Portugal, France, England, and the Netherlands. If you don't understand that, everything else will confuse you. Everything else will confuse you. And so this idea that our black bodies are sitting here talking the way that we're talking, and we're somewhat sure that when we get up and walk around, that there's not a lynch party waiting for us, that's a relatively new occurrence in our bodies. That is new. For most of our history, the white body has had, and I always say this to people, for most of our history, sis, the white body has had full and unfettered access to our bodies.
In a way where, for us, safety has been compromised because we are always on the lookout for intrusion. An intrusion can be so creative because it can be intrusion like touching my hair, or it can be intrusion like getting into my head in a way where I have to like really like peel back the layers of what was really said here, because I'm like, I'm confused, right? And sometimes it's just downright racist. And sometimes it's racist in a more explicit way, let's say.
I call it devout racist.
Devout.
Yeah.
I'm learning some things here and I'm loving it.
Quaking of America, I try and help us begin to grapple with. See, one of the things that happened with black bodies is that we end up going to the good, bad binary as a way to work around our relationships with white folks. So here's what I mean by that. We say, like, do you remember when Joe Rogan just recently, and you know, he came with all this, right? And you had all of these black folks saying, Joe Rogan is not a racist. Right. He ain't racist. Right. He, you know, I know Joe Rogan is racist. What they really mean is my personal relationship with Joe shows me and tells me that he's a good dude. Right. That's what they're really trying to say. But they have couched racism in the binary of good and bad, as opposed to systemic and structural, and how his idea lines up with that. Anytime you say you went to a movie theater and you walked into the Planet of Apes, your idea aligns with the idea of whiteness as the supreme standard by which all bodies humanity shall be measured structurally and philosophically. That's my whole thing about white body supremacy, is that if you don't understand that the white body deems and has deemed itself the supreme standard by which all bodies humanity shall be measured structurally and philosophically. And so the pigmentocracy enveloped in that concept is that the further you get away from whiteness, the less human you are. The race question in this country has always been a species question first.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, it's so interesting that you bring humanity as a concept into this conversation, because that was, as you were taking a moment and processing earlier on, I was in that shared humanity with you. And there was no question about the fact that you are a fellow human, right? And I even felt it as an honor to hold space with you, a duty as a fellow community member with you to just be here, right? And whatever, as you mentioned, like when we hold space, we're holding space for whatever may come. And I was willing and ready for that with you, right? And so I wonder, to what extent can white individuals be willing and ready to be in a shared humanity, even if that shared humanity means that they have to collectivize around action against the things that have created for them a default of humanity and not for others, right?
Well, what you just said is it means that they would have to confront stuff, not that, and not go around it. It's what I talk about in the book, Clean Pain and Dirty Pain. They don't have a collective understanding of how to go through this cleanly. There is no way for them to do it, and they don't want to be in the room with each other. For the next, and here's what I say is, so I just did the White Privilege Conference and then did the Psychotherapy Network, right? Mm-hmm. And this white woman came up to me, I'm signing books. She comes up to me, she goes, not white woman, white dude comes up to me, he goes. So first I say, well, you know, give me your book. And he goes, well, I don't have a book. I just have some things I want to say. And I'm like, here we go. Oh. Let me just put my pen over here. And
right.
He get ready. He gonna try and blow all of this vitriol through this 400 years of charge through me right now, because he don't want to hold it. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting there and I said, he said, well, I heard everything you said and I agree with it. I was like, and before he could get the rest, I said, no, you don't. I said, he said, what do you mean I don't? I said, I could tell by your cadence.
Yes.
Your cadence tells me. And he goes, what's my cadence? I said, and I did this. And I said, and I'm not going into teaching mode with you either. You're not going to do that either.
That's right. That's right.
And he goes, what? He's just saying, stop, right? And then I said, mm-hmm. He said, well, what is it white people need to do? Just answer that. I said, I'm going to give you this. I said, you can't do nothing with it, no way. I said, I already know you can't do nothing with it, but I'm going to give it to you, right? And then I said, check it out. I said, here's what you should do. I said, are you interested in really ushering in a living embodied anti-racist culture for white people? He said, yes. I said, so here's what you need to do. The first thing that you need to do is you need to get two other white male bodies, and y'all need to commit to each other for the next 30 years that no matter what, you're going to meet with each other and study with each other, and you're going to read My Grandmother's Hands. You're going to do the practices with each other. You're going to allow each other to be intimate with each other. You're going to allow each other to be seen. You're going to share stuff. You're going to witness when that other body starts to do something. You're going to observe when that other body starts to do something, and you're going to share, and you're going to create a level of intimacy over the next 30 years. So the babies that are born between the three of you are raised in a living, embodied, anti-racist culture. That's what you should do. He looked at me in all seriousness. He goes, that's hard. And I told
him. He don't want to know what's hard. I cannot. You literally gave him the recipe. Take the recipe and cook it up.
I told the guy who was standing there, who was ushering people through, I looked at him and he said, I got it. And he ushered dude on, right? Uh-huh. Because the level of brutality and the level of dirtiness that's baked into the cake for white folks, it goes unexamined by them, right? And what they want to do is they're so used to having access to our body, sis, that it disorients them when we don't have deference for them. When we don't defer to them, they don't know how to manage that.
Yeah. It's so interesting because, you know, when you were speaking to the things that you said, I felt such deep love. And I think that that's a lot of what I feel in your work. Your work has an undercurrent of love, you know, tough love, right? The love that we all need and like really strategic love. Like, here's how to do the work so that we can be in greater coexistence with one another. And it was almost like that was the approach to there, right?
It's always love. The undercurrent of everything that I do is always love. But people think that love is like mother's milk. Love is not mother's milk. Love asks you every day, who are you? Who do you want to be? What are you willing to do to be that? And as you do that, I'm here. Now, if you don't want to ask yourself the question and you don't want to work with the answers that show up, that does not automatically now become my work to do. Mm-hmm. It's always love. The things that I'm talking about is always love. And I will not let your concept of love be a Hallmark card and then ask me and black bodies to continue to carry the heavy load when your concept of love is only, we should all just love each other and hold each other and have teddy bears and flowers. If that's your concept of love, that concept of love doesn't have enough heat to transform anything.
I don't think that it's true love, right? It's superficial. It's superficial love. So it doesn't really kind of take into consideration the full needs of the person, right? That's in front of us. You saw the need for that person, regardless of the approach, right? Like, you saw that this person was in need of strategy, right? And although you wrote an entire book of strategies.
I even asked him, I said, have you read My Grandmother's Hands? He goes, no, I was thinking about it.
You know, you're better than me.
I know.
I can't. Like, start at square one. Sir, get it together.
Sir, I'm sir. That's it.
I mean, like, you know, the basics. And I think that he would be able to, should he be willing to really do the work, because My Grandmother's Hands is not a book you read, but a book you do, right? And so—
That's exactly right.
If he is willing to do the work within it continuously, I love that you said 30 years, continuously, right? Then he might be able to get a glimpse of the love that you were hoping to impart upon him.
Yeah, this piece, one of the reasons why I talk about, and I'm so glad you brought up the word love, is that I tell people all the time, I may not like everything that Black people do, but I love Black people, right? And for me, this idea that Black people, I think we're entering into a period of time right now where I'm seeing Black people do things with other Black people that I think is just so beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. I think I'm seeing us do things with each other that I don't think the generation before us saw. For instance, me and you met at the
Black Wellness.
That's right.
Black Mental Wellness Expo. So yes, shout out to the people that connected us, Angela Rye and Charlemagne, for holding it.
Do you realize that people like Angela and people like Charlemagne are giving access to people like us, mental health professionals, in ways that hasn't been done before? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I'm seeing things happen undercurrent, that people making relationships and doing things and creating these moorings for how we are going to be with each other, that the larger community, especially the white community, doesn't see. The access and the ways that people are taking care of each other Now, it's not perfect, but I'm seeing the seeds of this, what I call moorings, starting to happen, right? I have so much, people ask me, I had an interviewer say, Resmin, you know, we've been talking for an hour. And I get the sense that I want to ask you this question, but I don't know if you're going to like, if you're going to like beat me up if I ask a question. I said, I probably am. So you might as well just go and ask it, right? He said, you know, it just seems like you have no hope. I want to, you tell me one hopeful thing. I said, I don't have any hope for white America. I said, I don't. But for Black, Brown, and Indigenous people, I said, my hope is abundant. I was like, I'm watching stuff happen. I'm watching Indigenous people. I'm watching people in Hawaii, white or not white, but Indigenous Hawaiian sisters get up and speak on the mic and say stuff like, y'all need to leave. Mm. Y'all need to stop using our language. Y'all need to, right? This is our land, right? That's mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. That gives me hope, right? Having black women in my life, black women that I love, starting to say no. Just starting to say, one of the things that I believe is that the learning growth edge for black women specifically, the learning's growth edge is not doing, it's in the not doing.
Absolutely. It's in the soft moments that we have never had access to having ever. And now we're like, oh no, soft moments are going to be integrated into every single day of my life for the entirety of my life.
That's it. Yeah. That's where my hope mm-hmm. is. That's the hope.
I love that. I love that so much. And I share that hope with you. And I have seen it. And I've been so incredibly just humbled by the people that have connected us, that have been willing to open up space for us to not only to be in community, because that felt really good when we were all just like vibing and eating and just like, and just having a moment, right? Because we deserve those soft moments, but also so that we can open up space to heal our people and help heal our people and collectivize around healing and spread the tools that we have learned and bring ancient and ancestral wisdom into the mix. It's in all of it, because I think we're collectivizing with each other in a way that it's powerful, but it's also warm.
Yeah.
Like it just warms my heart. I'm like, yeah, I feel so good, y'all. I feel so good, you know? Like, yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And when we do that, like the smile on your face and the joy in your face, I really believe that when we have those times and we can string those times together, that literally helps heal our ancestors. I believe that the 250 years of legal rape on our bodies, both male and female black bodies, that rape thwarted emergence. It didn't kill it. It thwarted it. It tightened it, right? And I believe that when we take naps and we see each other and we laugh and we have them big belly laughs and we talk to each other and we, what you doing? Like that type of stuff, right? Like, mm-hmm. That cadence, yep. That soft cadence. Mm-hmm. That part, I believe our ancestors, they can let their shoulders drop a little bit and their face can soften and their sense of being has more space. And I also believe that it also allows for the children that are to come through with a sense of space that they didn't have, that they wouldn't have had if we hadn't have done this type of work.
I could, as you know, just talk to you forever about all of this. I feel like I had to sit with that for just a moment, because that just held so much for me. I think so much for many. I'd like to ask you a question that I think it's a question that maybe feels deduced, maybe simplistic. However, because there is so much, right? There's so much that we have to do, even in this very moment, there's so much. But I wonder, in the context of breaking cycles, generational cycles, what is your take on how we can begin to do the work today? Beyond buying your books and signing up to your cultural somatics workshops, because people need to do that ASAP. But if you can enlighten us, what would you suggest is for any of us globally, how can we start right now?
Well, you do one piece, as you did it at the beginning for me. Pause each other. I'm here. I can't cure this for you. I can't wish it away. I can't sprinkle pixie dust on it. I can't shake it to chicken bones and throw them and then that gets rid of it. Yeah, I know. You know, Vadoon is a real thing, right?
Yeah.
But what I can do is be with you. What I can do is rock with you. What I can do is hum with you. What I can do is moan with you. What I can do is let you wail. What I can do is growl. What I can do is grunt. What I can do is wiggle. What I can do is orient. What I can do is move. What I can do is dance. What I can do is laugh. What I can do is send you stupid pet videos. What I can't, you know what I mean? I can do that. And that helps to set the ground for other mergers to possibly happen. And we think those things are throwaways. Those things are necessary and essential to our healing, right? When I hear one of the most joyous things in my life is making my wife laugh and tears start coming down her face and her hitting me on the chest telling me to stop, right? That shit for me is like, you know what I mean? And so people think that healing is some type of prescriptive thing. Healing is always present. We just have to slow down and condition and temper our bodies enough to be able to recognize what's in the field, as opposed to acting like things are not in the field and we need to put it in the field. It's already in the field.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you know what? That actually makes it doable, accessible, right? Because I think that when we're talking about healing, especially something as layered as racialized healing, as layered as generational healing, people will start to think like, this feels overwhelming. I don't even know if I can. But if you can just look at what's already there and just stretch that out, right? Like you're saying, yeah.
That's it. My grandmother, the woman I was talking about in the story, I talked about rubbing her hands because her hands were fat because of the scarring and everything. My grandmother had the funniest sense of humor and she would just laugh. My grandmother used to fart all the time. She would just fart, right? And then we'd like, grandma, like that. And she would just like,
just big belly laugh.
This shake, yeah. Right? That's healing. Love it. That's healing.
Yeah.
That also conditioned my nervous system to be acclimated towards humor. That's how I think we began to do that. It's what I call, I really think that in Black people's lives, we think about the closest we can get to creation sometimes is we think it's either through Islam or through Christianity or through yoga or something like that. And what I tell people is that we are, that the Black, especially the Black woman, all of us come from a Black woman, right? We all, I mean, even white folks, right? You know what I'm starting to read now? I didn't even know this was a thing. Honestly, I didn't even know this was a field. Do you know there's a whole field right now dedicated to when Europeans started to develop pale skin?
That's wild.
Right. And so my whole piece is, how do we begin to work with these pieces, be reconnected to creation itself? We are part of creation, not apart from creation. And part of creation is joy and laughter. Like the thing that I do all the time now, like on Instagram, like I love dog videos.
Me too.
I love dog videos.
I'm huge fan.
Like, I think huskies might be the closest thing to humans that I've ever seen. Yes. Right?
Yes.
I love baby videos. I love like all, why? I do it because it helps to condition my body to work with the softness, with the silliness, with the playing, right? And so that's why I believe that there's an emergent Blackness, an emergent that comes out of creation itself, right? That is not the kind of bestowal type of religion or spirituality where something is, but all you got to do is pray long enough and then something is bestowed upon you. I believe that when creation decided it was going to create the first representation of humanness on this earth, that was a Black woman. And everything else came from, all of us came from that, right? And so part of my work, I believe, is to reorient people to creation and reorient people to this kind of emergent Blackness, not just as skin pigmentation, but emergent Blackness as in everything that comes forth. Light came, what they call the Big Bang was an emergence of light, right? The light was always there, but the Blackness opened and gave more room so the light could go through.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I hear you also talking about how we reconnect to our truth, the truth that we have been disjointed from. I hear that.
That's it.
I hear that.
That's it.
I honor that. Mm. For me, for you, for all of us, I honor that.
Thank you.
Wow. I hope that you feel as enlightened as I do, as fired up as I do, and that you can appreciate Rezma's words and his authenticity, and also that you can appreciate his call to action for all of us to take sustainable, actionable steps toward making sure that we take care of ourselves, but simultaneously taking care of the disease of racism. If you haven't already, please purchase The Quaking of America. Every time I read Rezma's work, I feel enlightened, challenged, I feel ready, and I know that you will too. You can follow him at Rezma Menakem on social and also check out his work at Rezma.com. Now, whenever we're talking about trauma, remember that the nervous system registers it and it can make you feel uneasy. So I would like to offer us all, myself included, this sound bath meditation, so that we can recalibrate, restore ourselves, be well, breathe easy, all of the above. So whenever you're ready, if you're willing, and if your body is capable, I invite you into the sound bath meditation. I invite you to lower your gaze if that feels safe to you. I invite you to take in a deep breath, to honor your body, to welcome in this practice. I'll take that breath with you. And let's begin. Whenever you're ready, increase your gaze or open your eyes. Just wiggle your fingers and toes just to let them know, hey, I'm back, I'm here, I'm safe. I'd like for you to remember that in this moment, right here and right now, you have an opportunity to choose to break the cycle. I hope that you take care of that beautiful soul of yours, and I will catch you at the next episode. Thank you.